Artists are thought leaders and change makers who transform culture, reflecting our current humanity back to ourselves. We must endeavor to shift the national psyche so that artists are neither at the bottom or the top of the hierarchy, but at the heart.
Welcome to Voices of the Community, where we dive deep into the heart of Northern California, exploring the issues that matter most. This episode is part of our second season, shining a spotlight on the vibrant and resilient arts and culture scene, a driving force in our community's identity and well-being. Our second season features highlights from the second annual California Arts and Culture Summit, organized by our partner, California for the Arts. This year's theme, Artwork is Real Work, underscores the vital role artists play in our economy and well-being, despite often lacking the support they need. We'll hear from leading voices on topics like arts and health, economic justice, climate change, youth engagement, and more, all with a focus on the public policies needed to support our creative industries. The summit's opening ceremony featured Nafisha Ezreal from California for the Arts, Letitia Rye Buckley from La Plaza de Cultural Y Arts, and Julie Baker of California for the Arts, along with the keynote speaker, Nataki Garrett of One Nation, One Project, and Arts for Everybody.
Let's give it up one more time for Ms. C and Studio C Arts and Entertainment. My name is Nafisha Ezreal. I'm the Director of Programs with California for the Arts, and welcome to our second annual Arts and Culture Summit. And I'm going to share one really, really short thing, and then we're going to have our land acknowledgement. I'm a poet, and I just wrote a short thing. We each live many lives, unique, beautiful, painful, and incredibly meaningful lives. And if we are lucky enough, we get to live many lives in this one life we are given. We share this moment of our lives as a gift, one that we must acknowledge, embrace, and remember. In this moment, we must remember the humanity in the person next to us, across from us, behind us, and in front of us. We are here to grow and develop a world that we can be proud to say in one is one that we helped formulate. As we go through this day, let us remember the humanity that surrounds us, the humanity that we each so diligently pour into and serve with a voracious love. As we learn and share, I want to remember a quote by one of my life guides, Maya Angelou. When you learn, teach. When you get, give. Next up is Letitia Rye Buckley, and she will be giving our land acknowledgement. Thank you.
Good morning. Good morning. Good morning. That music took me back to high school, but then my glasses brought me back to my 50s. So don't mind me. Good morning, everybody. Buenos dias. No, 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 no. We got to do that one more time. Good morning.
Good morning.
Ooh, I like it. It is so wonderful to be here to see so many friends, familiar faces, colleagues. I hope you're ready for one amazing day. You didn't know that was a question. All right. Welcome to Sacramento. The history of the Sacramento area and the people is rich in heritage, culture, and tradition. This area was and still is the tribal land of the Nisenan people. Sacramento was a gathering place for many local tribes who have lived throughout the Central Valley and the foothills for generations and were the original stewards of this land. We acknowledge the southern Maidu people to the north, the Valley and Plains Miwok and Miwok peoples to the south of the American River, and the Patwin Wintun peoples to the west of the Sacramento River. We also honor the Wilton Rancheria, the only federally recognized tribe in Sacramento County. We acknowledge that we are standing on the tribal lands of Sacramento's indigenous people. We acknowledge people of African descent brought to this country and indigenous land, whose labor and bodies have been and still are exploited and brutalized. We honor their ongoing resistance to genocide and colonization. We recognize the role arts and cultural institutions, policies, and systems have historically played in upholding colonial practices and are working to decolonize those systems through our conversations here today and in our daily work. We thank Showing Up for Racial Justice in Sacramento and Sacramento Native American Health Center for providing resources for this acknowledgement. And now I would like to take just one moment to thank the staff of Californians for the Arts and California Arts Advocates. Thank them for bringing us together and feeding our mind, our body, and our soul. And without further ado, please welcome CEO of California for the Arts and California Arts Advocates, Julie Baker.
Good morning, Sacramento, California Arts and Culture Summit. How we doing? Are we feeling good? Excellent. I'm so glad. It is such a joy to see you all here today. And come on in. There's plenty of seats in the front. Don't be afraid. I don't spit. At least not that far. So I've got all my timing here. I got to start my timing so I don't go off, right? Because I tend to, anyone know me? I'm pretty verbose, right? So sorry for that. We're going to go to the next slide. There we go. All right. So California for the Arts and California Arts Advocates. I want to just tell you a little bit about who are your hosts? Who are we? I mean, hopefully most of you know about us and have come to some of our webinars or the event last year or Advocacy Day and all the things that we put together. But we're two separate organizations, a C3, a nonprofit, and a C4 lobbying organization that share a small but mighty team and a vision. With the support of our members, thank you for the members. Shout out if you're a member. And to our partners, thanks to all the partners we work with, we work to fortify and empower the cultural sector and end the era of the starving artist. Yes? In the last 5 years, we have seen historic legislation and unprecedented funding for the arts, culture and creative industries, and workforce here in California. You all made that happen. So give yourselves a round of applause. We have seen a narrative shift in the perception of careers in the arts as legitimate work. Artwork is real work. Can I hear you say it? I'm going to say it. Artwork is
real work.
Artwork is
real work.
And I have to give a shout out to Kristen Dolan from the California Desert Arts Council. Are you here, Kristen? Because Kristen is the one who coined that, and then the Office of California, Office of Small Business Advocate, Tara Lynn Gray, who was with us last year, wrote a blog post about artwork is real work, right? So that's what's happening. We're infiltrating. So it's legitimate work and the creative industries as critical to California's economy. This is the narrative shift that you are all engaged in and the essential role artists play in responding to civic issues and infrastructural innovation. Next slide, please. I do have to acknowledge this team that is really working incredibly hard with dedication and passion to bring this work to reality, right? How many of you produce events? Events are a big deal to undertake, and we're a virtual organization. Our team is all throughout the state of California, Fresno to Ventura to Nevada City, where I live. We are everywhere in the state of California, and I just want to thank the team for their incredible hard work. So join me in thanking them. Next slide, please. I also want to thank our board members. We have 23 amazing board members around the state of California. If you're a board member, please stand up right now and say, I'm here. If you're a former board member, I want you to stand up as well. Thank you to our board members. Next slide. Thank you. Hopefully you noticed some of our new branding. Not only we undertook this last year, introducing new websites, new brands, new logos, and actually slight change of the name. California for the Arts versus Californians for the Arts. Part of that was because many of you confused it anyway. And we wanted to really put the logo together, right? So we're grounded here in California. We know the arts and culture are essential to California. This is our grounding with the CA in the middle. So hopefully you visited our new websites and you get a chance to download many of the resources. And thank you to everyone who comes up to me and to our team and tells us, we use your resources. We use them in our community and we use that to build the case making. So thank you for that. We're also launching a strategic plan and I'm going to give you some preview to that. We've hired Salvador Acevedo of Scansion and David Holland of Westaf, two of the most brilliant people I know, to work with us. And next slide, if I could. One of the things we are absolutely committed to as an organization is cultural equity. Now, everyone has to come up with their own definitions of what things mean for your organization. And this is our definition. We advocate for the redistribution of power and resources so all of California's diverse cultural communities have the autonomy to hold and share joy, exist in physical spaces, guide public policies, and secure investments to contribute to the state's civic and spiritual life. Next slide. Our strategic goals, and these are just some of them, I just want to give you an idea, advancing the creative workforce through cultural equity as you defined in our programming like this, policy development, coalition building, and shared leadership, to mobilize creative workers and cultural communities with other aligned sectors like you're going to hear from today, like health, to develop public policies where arts and culture serve as drivers of community health and economic development, and to develop a local and regional approach to arts and culture advocacy that emphasizes the empowerment and self-determination of creative workers to build regional advocacy networks. All politics are local. We must start in our local communities, and we need you to activate in that way, and we are here to support with whatever you need. Next slide, please. I just want to give you a little bit of a case study. One of the things that we worked on, and many people in this room worked on this, because this is the dance. Grassroots and grass tops advocacy. We work together, right? We have a lobbyist, we have a lobbying organization, and then we have advocates all over the state. And one of the things, as many of you know, we're in a performing arts center right now. The performing arts have really had a terrible, hard time, right? Between employment law changes, such as AB 5, from COVID impact into audiences changing and the behavior is changing, we've seen a decline in opportunities for our performing arts centers to survive and thrive. And so we, along with Arts for LA, who's in the house, and Civil Economics, who we commissioned to do the study, and Actors Equity, who I think is in the house, and the Theater Producers League of Southern California in the house, we all worked together to put together some case making and some data, right? You got to start with data. How many of you understand? We got to start with the data. But data enough is not enough. We got to bring our storytelling, our incredible storytelling. This is what you all do for a living. Take the data, build the story, right? That's what we need to do. So I don't need to read this. You all know what's happened in the last several years for the performing arts. Next slide. So we do the data, we do the case making, we do the rallies. You had incredible amount of grassroots advocates throughout the state of California leading a coalition for SB 1116. SB 1116 was authored by Senator Anthony Portantino, who we are going to celebrate tomorrow at Arts Advocacy Day. And it's a way to help those organizations, small nonprofit performing arts organizations, with their payroll costs, because this is what's really increased, not alone production costs and all the other things, but due to employment law change. Now, let me just say this. Many people said, why aren't we getting exempt from AB 5? And I'll tell you this. We want art workers to thrive in California. They need to be paid a living wage. We should not be fighting to get rid of that. So what do we do? We work together with you. We work on the case making. We work on the advocacy networks to build all of this. We support in strategy and then all the social media that goes along with it. And then we hopefully get public policy like SB 1116 that was signed into law. It has about $12 million attached to it, even in this budget time. And we're going to see it implemented with the California Office of Small Business Advocate. We have a 2-hour meeting scheduled with them tomorrow to talk about implementation. So advocacy does not end when the law gets signed or the money gets attached to it. You have to hold the agencies accountable. You continue to have a role, whether that's in your local community or whether that's at the state. That's our case study. And for those who are involved in it, thank you. And raise your hand if you were involved in the SB 1116 coalition. Anyone signed a letter for it? You were a part of this. Thank you. Next slide. Part of our work, too, is that we also do research ourselves. So some of you, 1,600 of you actually responded to a survey we did the first quarter of this year. Thank you for that. And this really helps us to understand what's going on out there, because obviously our 23-person board member, our 9-person staff, has hopefully our eyes and ears on what's going on, but we need to hear from you, because this is how we do it together, and this is how we ensure that this is not done from a top-down perspective. This is done from all of us working together. So individuals and organizations, you can see common insufficient public funding. You're not going to be surprised by that. You can see where they came from. You can see what the challenges are, and some of them I've already spoken to. So lack of access to affordable housing. This is a consistent theme that we hear. It doesn't matter where you live in the state of California. We know this is a crisis. What is our role in that? How can we help to impact policy change that's going to help artists and cultural bearers and organizations to be able to stay in the communities they help to build, right? We do not want artists to get kicked out of the communities they're helping to build. And I'm so pleased because we were able to get a bill passed with Tasha Borner, who I saw last night at the Sheraton. She stays there three nights a week because this is what our lawmakers do. They come here for three nights, and then they go back to their homes, right? They are civil servants. They are working extremely hard, earnestly, some maybe not so much, to solve problems. And that is what legislation should do, is solve problems. And you have to bring the problem to them for them to solve. So this gives you an idea of what we found. Next slide. Thank you for reminding me. What are our policy priorities coming out of this then? So 82% of you that took the survey said you would advocate for increased funding for the CAC, the State Arts Agency. Thank you, because I'm going to show you a slide why that's important. You also said you would diversify and increase sources of state funding for the arts through cross-sector initiatives. That means, like, let's talk about arts and health. Let's talk about arts and small business. Let's talk about arts and transportation. Let's talk about arts and housing. Let's talk about arts and ending poverty. Let's talk about arts and youth. All of the ways that we know you're making an impact, we should be invested in, paid for that work, and we should be celebrated for what we do. Yes. Increase access to affordable housing in our workspaces, as we talked about, and social safety nets for the self-employed. We still have people who are self-employed, right? We got 1099 workers in our industry, a lot of them. What are we doing to make sure that in between gigs, they are surviving? What are we doing? Nothing yet, but we're going to change that, right? Next slide. Top motivations to participate in advocacy ranked in order. This is from you. When a trusted colleague, friends ask me to advocate, I show up. Does that feel true for you? The policy change directly impacts my work or livelihood. The issue educates policymakers on the value of the arts, even if it doesn't directly impact me, which I love. Thank you for that, right? Because we cannot just be thinking about ourselves. We need to think about collective impact. We need to think about each other. We have to care for each other in this moment in time. And participating makes me feel like I'm building a movement. Yes, yes, we are. And 77% of you are likely to take action in some form of advocacy. Next slide. Important to our work is also showing how much impact we have. And sometimes I'm like, oh, we don't need this slide. But then I remember not everybody, even in this room, knows how important you are to California's economy. And it's not just about economy. I understand that. But the economy is what we need to talk to about to our lawmakers, because the economy right now is the big conversation, right? We've got about a $72 billion deficit in California. They just shored up $17 billion in cuts. It's going to continue. It's going to be a tough 3 years. But we need to continue to build the case making that says we are important. We are essential. In fact, we are $290 billion in economic output. This is just arts and culture alone, for-profit and nonprofit. 8% of the California economy, close to 850,000 jobs, and $507 billion in gross value added when you do the whole of the creative economy, almost 2 million creative workers. You're talking about, with ripple effects, almost $1 trillion for the creative industries. We are ahead of agriculture, transportation, construction. Are you with me? That's right. The arts and culture and creative industries are essential to California. It is our job to illustrate that on the daily. Sorry, we cannot do it once a year. We have to be consistent in our advocacy. Next slide. This is just quickly, some of you have already seen this. This is where we are with state funding and why we need to continue to advocate for the CAC. For in the year 2003, the CAC was at $30.7 million in local assistance funding. And if you adjust for inflation, that's actually an old number. We should be at $54 million if you adjust for inflation. And I believe every one of us has to adjust for inflation. Have our costs not gone up, right? Okay. 10 years, that agency's budget was $1 million. I'm sure many of you in this room remember that. And many of you, like in this room, including I can always see Rick Steins. There's Rick, fought for this, and we hired our lobbyist, Jason Schmeltzer, who's amazing. And you can see the stair step, right? 8 million, 15 million. We had a year where we had the largest increase of 10 million. We got one-time funding over COVID. That was incredible. 60 million for the Creative Core. How many of you are involved in the Creative Core? I love the Creative Core. I think the Creative Core is what we need to build. It shows how artists should be employed in service to civic issues for public good. Sorry. I get fired up about the Creative Core. I see you, Kern. Kern County has amazing statistics about what they've been doing with the Creative Core. It is an incredible program. It is now unfunded. So what do we need to do? We need to make sure that this is not a pilot, but this is sustained funding. And someone from the CAC said to me yesterday, I think it's a really important point. You know, when we want to ensure for cultural equity, we cannot go into communities and say, we're going to invest in you and the HBI and all the things in this community that had been disinvested in. And we're not going to come in, and we come in one time. And we get you excited, and we give you the money, and we do these programs, and then we leave. And then you're right back, and maybe even we've caused more harm. This is not a thing that we need to continue. We need to continue with sustained funding. We cannot continue the harm that we are doing to communities by saying we're investing in disinvested communities one time. That is not going to change the system. All right, I got to look at my timer. Ooh, I got 5 minutes. Okay, next slide. How has arts advocacy changed? All right, record number of people. Okay, COVID was awful. COVID continues to be awful. Many things in this world continue to be awful. I don't need to list what's going on in our world. But one of the things that came out of it, the silver lining, is that we had so many more people engage in specifically arts and culture advocacy. You have stepped up, and we have seen that if we mobilize and we build these new coalitions, we work very closely with for-profit organizations like that represent like independent venues like NIVA, National Independent Venues Association. We work with Cal nonprofits. We work with all these different organizations. California Association of Museums is in the house, and the Association of California Symphony Orchestras. And there's all these people all around the state and the United States working to really change how arts and culture are perceived in our public policies. And so that's what's happening now. And it's incredibly exciting to see. So we need to continue that, though. We cannot just engage when it's urgent. We have to engage consistently. That's how change happens. So these are the other things that we've seen how arts advocacy has changed. Next slide, please. The other thing is that I think I've talked about this. I said it at the top of my conversation is really, you know, for so long we've come to talk to policymakers and we're like, you know, you don't invest in us enough. We're underinvested in, right? Well, what sector doesn't think that, right? So that's not a compelling argument. We can't come with our hand out. We can't say we need your help. We need to walk in and say, we got you. We are part of the solution. And you have underutilized this workforce for far too long. And stop taking advantage of us and use us when you need us, right? When they're saying, oh, can you come? And this is my friend Brandon from Actors Equity always says this. Artists are always asked, you know, can you do it for exposure? You'll do it for exposure, right? He says, you'll die from exposure, right? So let's get real here. This is an underutilized workforce. The Creative Core is showing that. We can prove with data and with impact in all the different issue areas. We've got so much data around the impact of arts and health. Do you know that if you engage in arts activities once a month for a year, it can extend your life by 10 years, which means everyone in this room is going to live to 200. We have 5 pillars. Youth, health, social justice, economy, and community. Those are our pillars that we've been developing narratives around. Every month during Arts, Culture, and Creativity Month, our incredible comms team, Eduardo, Jean, LT, Nefesha, the whole team is comms. Our organization is communications. That's all we do, right? We gotta tell our stories. And that's a lot of what we've been working on in our toolkits. Next slide. This year, as you can see, our main, message is artwork is real work. And you'll see all the other ways that we're telling that story. And if you haven't downloaded our social media toolkit, it's not too late. April is still here. We're on this mid-April. So continue to share those messages out there if you would. Next slide. All right, so just quickly some highlights in terms of our collective impact, and some of the images you'll see on the left are also from older Arts, Culture, and Creativity Month pieces that we've done, and Artists Are Second Responders was a narrative that we've developed that a lot of people respond to, and I think there's so much more that we can be doing around that, and I look to all of you, the storytellers in this room, to help us build that. But, you know, you can see some of the highlights here. In 2020, when things were really bad, we were able to get $50 million with our friends at CAM, for example, and Cal Nonprofits for cultural institutions. The very beginning, we could talk about first closed, last to reopen. We weren't even in the guidelines. Remember that? Remember when we weren't in the guidelines? And they were like, yeah, when the COVID's over, you can reopen. We're like, this was at the height of COVID. What do you mean? So we organized a task force. We had 50 people in our task force from top to bottom. In the state of California, we were able to meet directly with the Governor's Office of Business and Economic Development, the Department of Public Health, and we were able to say, you know, arts organizations and arts workers actually take care of people, right? You're allowing bars and bowling alleys to be open, but our performing arts centers need to be closed? That makes zero sense to us. And that was a lack of education. They didn't understand how we take care of our patrons. We care about how things are safe. Public safety is extremely important to every venue I've ever worked with. So we were able to get the reopening guidelines together for live events. And that was really the beginning of our deeper relationship with the Governor's Office of Business and Economic Development, headed up by Dee Dee Myers. Back in 2021, again, historic relief funding and the California Creative Workforce Act, which established that the creative workforce development is a state priority. So that's a pretty cool thing. Next slide. You're going to hear about some funding for Arts in the Parks. Some of the folks from Arts in the Parks are here today, I think. Yes, yes. And, okay, this is huge, and you guys know this already, but Prop 28, all right? $1 billion potentially annually to arts education. And yes, we know it's not perfect yet, and that is why we have accountability advocacy, and that is why our partners at Create California, who are here, are working to make sure that it is not supplanting, but supplementing in your communities for arts education funding. Last year, we were able to get $1 million passed in a very tight budget for something called the California Creative Economy Strategic Plan. This was something we saw modeled in the state of Washington. We pitched it to legislators. Thankfully, the former speaker picked it up, Anthony Rendon. Wendy Carrillo picked it up, assembly member, and we were able to get that into the budget. And we now have a creative economy working group at the state level, includes the Secretary of Labor. Okay, in the Creative Economy Working Group. It includes the head of California Office of Small Business Advocate. It includes all of these people because we need to work together across our state agencies to integrate and infiltrate arts and culture into these solution sets, right? Because let's be honest, I would love to see the CAC have hundreds of millions of dollars in funding. I would love to see the NEA, the NEH, all of the arts councils, all your local arts agencies be fully funded, right? So that we can really do the work in a way that actually has dignity for our workforce. That is what's critically important. But let's also be honest. This is a long game. It's not going to happen fast. So we need to look for other ways to find that funding now, whether that's through other state agencies that have maybe larger budgets. That's one of the things that we're also always looking at. Next slide. I'm almost done. All right, 24-25 priorities, supporting growth of advocacy networks across the state. We have a really great program, and we're thankful to the Music Man Foundation and others here that have funded us to build something called RAIN, Regional Advocacy Infrastructure Network. We started here in Sacramento and in San Diego, and it's really to help you, to give you the tools to build your local advocacy, because, again, all politics are local. We're going to prioritize issue areas like health, housing, and workforce programs grounded in cultural equity. We actually have hired someone to work with us on an arts and health policy brief, and I'm so excited about some of the things you're going to hear today. Technical assistance for state grants. In the last several years, we've helped close to 4,000 arts organizations access all of that relief funding with our amazing Terry Ball, if any of you have worked with her, for technical assistance. And again, sustained investment in arts and culture. All right, next slide. This is it. What are the big ideas, folks? What are the big ideas? Because we are not here to play as usual, are we? No. Because what are we? We are the most innovative, imaginative people in the state of California. Yes? artists. So what are the big ideas? And I'm not going to answer that question because I want you guys to answer that question. I want you to feel that today. I want you to get to know us, get to know each other, to get inspired, hopefully, by the panels that you're hearing today, and to think about what can we do. And there's an opportunity today in the afternoon. It says open mic. It's not for you to sing, although you can. I know there's talent in this room. Ricky, I expect you to sing. I expect Ricky to sing and LT. But here's the thing. You'll have a chance to come up to the mic. We have 45 minutes. You're going to chance to practice public comment, 2 to 3 minutes, and talk to us about what we didn't talk about today, what you're not hearing today, or something that sparked you and or something you're doing in your community. I'd love to hear from Kern. We're going to hear from them later in Pechacucha. And we've got that's coming up too. All right. So here's what I'm going to conclude with. And yes, I went long. I'm sorry. This always happens. All right. Together, we can create a world where arts and culture are recognized and invested in as essential to society, embedded in community life, and intersect with broader policy change to reshape systems towards equity and justice. Where we can advance cultural equity to ensure diverse forms of artistic and cultural expression are represented and supported, and envision a world where artists are paid with thriving wages and conditions for their contributions to society, and finally, a world where we can, quote, incite joy. And now I'm going to quote from Ross Gay, who I had the opportunity to see in my little town because of Nevada County Arts Council and our library, who brought him for the Sierra Poetry Festival. He's the author of Inciting Joy. He's amazing. Quote, my hunch is that joy is an ember for or precursor to wild and unpredictable and transgressive and unboundaried solidarity. And that this solidarity might incite further joy, which might incite further solidarity. My hunch is that joy emerging from our common sorrow, which does not necessarily mean we have the same sorrows, but that we in common sorrow might draw us together. It might depolarize us and de-atomize us enough that we can consider what, in common, we love. It's why I think of joy, which gets us to love, as being a practice of survival. Thank you.
Welcome back to Voices of the Community, where we delve into critical issues facing Northern California communities. Voices of the Community is made possible by generous support from the Zellerbach Family Foundation, dedicated to ensuring vibrant work is created, new voices celebrated, and diverse communities have opportunities to thrive. Learn more at zff.org. We're also supported by the Peaceful World Foundation, fostering a culture of global peace through hosted conversations and education. Discover more at peacefulworldfoundation.org. Before returning to the summit, enjoy an excerpt from our one-on-one interview with Deborah Cullinan, the Vice President for the Arts at Stanford University, who moderates the panel on arts and health and will be featured in our next episode.
Hi, my name is Eduardo Robles with Californians for the Arts and Voices of the Community. We just got out of the Arts and Health panel. And I have our moderator, Deborah Cullinan, and we just wanted to do some follow-up questions on some key takeaways from the panel you just moderated, just projects. What's your takeaways on kind of cross-sector partnerships, on research emerging, on arts and prescription, on basically the topic areas that you guys were covering? What are you taking away, or what are you offering to, you know, the public mm-hmm. to take away?
Yeah, thank you. I think I'm taking away a couple of things. And one of them is that it's unequivocal. We know that art and creativity in our lives, early, often, and always, is good for us. Two, we can integrate art and creativity into the systems and structures that make up our lives. And in the case here, into healthcare systems. We can do it. And I think the third is just try. Like, my message to people is, if you can find a few people on your college campus, in your community college system, in your local community center that believe that being able to prescribe art and creativity to people will help advance their health outcomes, help them to be happy and healthy, then find a way to create a system and test it. Gather the evidence and then tell the story of impact. I think the last thing that I would say is this work is really about systems change and integrating into systems or creating new ones. It's about being bold enough to believe that we can, because these are our systems, they are our institutions, and they need to be designed by us and made for us and for the communities that they serve. And we can integrate into those systems, but it is culture changing work. It is changing your heart and your mind and engaging you in a way that will help us to change the system, right? So the last thing I will say is I think this panel painted such a beautiful picture of what the future can be, a picture that is about creativity and health and well-being and people everywhere, no matter what, who want to be here and are engaged in all of the ways that human beings should be engaged.
Thank you so much, Deborah, for your key takeaways.
Joining our roaming reporter, Eduardo Robles, from the California Arts and Culture Summit is Liz Luke, the Executive Director of Living Jazz. Liz leads an organization dedicated to enriching lives through the power of jazz music, education, and community. Stay tuned to hear her insights on the transformative role of arts in our society.
We're here at the California Arts and Culture Summit, and I have with me
Liz Luke, Executive Director of Living Jazz.
And also a board member of California's for the Arts.
Very proud board member. It's a great board.
Yeah, so today, I mean, we're celebrating Arts, Culture, and Creativity Month this April. The theme is Artwork is Real Work. The summit revolves around the theme Artwork is Real Work. What were you most inspired by that theme?
I was really inspired by the talks around how art impacts wellness, social wellness. We work with a lot of youth for my job. And we've just seen so many issues. Like, for example, the amount of prescriptions our nurse has to deal with doubled after the pandemic. And we have a lot of kids who are facing depression and mental health issues. And we get calls from the parents saying, we're sending your child to your camp. Can you please help? And the arts is healing. We really do heal and transform their lives. So great to hear more about that from others.
Yeah. We're seeing like different models of how, you know, art and culture is being, you know, deployed for solutions. How do you feel being part of this movement? You have a youth focus, but like, are you inspired, you know, to take home any of these strategies?
Oh yeah, I was writing notes in my journal all day. I got a million ideas to take back to my team. It was just real great. It's inspiring to get people from all over the state of California and hearing different interpretations, and no one has all of the knowledge, so you just pick up little nuggets and you take it home, and that's the point of these conferences, right? Take home those knowledge, those learnings, those kernels, and bring it back and put it into your own little community and system.
So what's the importance of like a summit like this?
I think it's really important to get all the power, all of the community, all of the resources in one space. Everything just happens so much faster. Partnerships happen, resources are redistributed, ideas are shared, and it just expedites the timeline a bit more.
Thank you so much, Liz, for taking the time to let us know how our work is real work. And
our work is real work, that's right.
Let's rejoin the summit's opening ceremony and hear from keynote speaker Nataki Garrett, who champions artists, especially those from marginalized communities, and advocates for structural changes in arts organizations to better support artists' financial security and creative endeavors.
All right. Am I ready for our keynote? It's my pleasure to introduce Nataki Garrett. Nataki is a changemaker, trailblazer, and is the CEO and executive director of The Ladder Approach, executive coaching, as well as the co-artistic director of One Nation, One Project. Are you familiar with that? It's so awesome. And is leading their national arts and health initiative, Arts for Everybody. In 2020, she co-founded the theater advocacy organization Professional Nonprofit Theater Coalition, a national coalition organized to help the theater industry advocate for the $15 billion Shuttered Venue Operators Grant of historically unprecedented funding from the federal government. Because why? Because we can do that. Nataki Garrett served as the executive and artistic director of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival and the acting artistic director of the Denver Center for the Performing Arts. Her vision is to support artists, to manifest innovation, to inspire creativity, and to ensure the future of performance by centering artists as thought leaders and change makers who transform culture. An accomplished director and producer of stage, film, Garrett created and produced Quills Fest, the first of its kind event intersecting XR and theater, as well as the Cymbeline Project. Garrett is executive producer of films You Go Girl and Ashland. Additional awards and recognition include the Bronze Telly Award, the AMPA Creative Innovation Award, the Ammerman Award for Directing, the United States Artist Fellowship, and the National Directing Fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts and Theater Communications Group. Garrett has served on nominating committees, panels, and countless juries supporting artists around the world, frequently sought voice for her thought leadership and expertise. We welcome Nataki Garrett.
Thank you. Oh, good. Hi, everybody. Thanks for that. I'm going to use an iPad because then I can make the words bigger so I can see them. I'm so inspired. I mean, all of that really amazing information that was just shared. I'm just so inspired by the things that we do and all that we are as artists. So when I say artists, you know, we kind of picture the starving, the struggling artists, the tortured artists, even us artists don't like to admit when we're happy for fear that the universe will retaliate and we'll never be happy again. When I say happy artists, it sounds so strange to say it out loud. You know, like a spoiled dilettante with a trust fund who can't succeed in any other profession, someone who isn't serious about how to make a life in America. Someone whose life fills the tabloids for our entertainment. And while I also loved watching the stories of music legends in Behind the Music, remember that from the, remember? I'm clear that I relished in the fall more than the rise. Why aren't we valued? Because no matter how valuable, how healing, how transformative our work can be, artists themselves are not wholly valued as critical in our society. As artists, our work is extractable, a commodity, entertaining, interesting, compelling, shocking, consumable. But like the brave athletes who took a knee to protest police brutality, I can't tell you how often I feel like society is demanding that we artists just shut up and art. My name is Nataki Garrett. I'm Alice Gertrude's great-granddaughter. I'm Lillian Venus's granddaughter. I'm Cheryl's daughter. I'm Io Daley's mommy. And I'm wearing the bracelets that she made me to remind me of how blessed I am to be living right here and right now. I was born in D.C., but I'm Oaktown all day. Raised in the 70s and the 80s. That's the right time, right? I'm an artist and a leader who has gone through all the phases, from starving artist to trending, then I was canceled on Facebook, and everything in between. And I've dedicated my life to my profession. And I can tell you that working to center the people who make and create art isn't easy. It requires dismantling long-held misconceptions and perceptions about the role of artists in our systems of hierarchy. As the world continues to roll the clock back on women's rights and DEI gets spun into severe untruths like didn't earn it, what the hell is that? And as we allow grown-ups to make the rules, rules that harm trans and non-binary people, especially children, we need to consider reframing the way we value artists in our society by considering the critical role artists play in our own personal lives and experiences. If we do, the world will benefit. So when I was 4 years old, my mother took me to see Swan Lake at the Kennedy Center in D.C. She was an early childhood educator and just earned her master's degree. We didn't have a lot of money, but she was able to get tickets. We were so far away from the privilege of the orchestra seating. We sat high in the rafters, so far away from the stage. Our seats were basically on the other side of the Potomac. Now, I can't imagine bringing my 4-year-old daughter to the ballet because, you know, she's crazy. And I don't remember the looks from the patrons who were afraid that I'd be loud or fidgety, but I remember watching those little dots on stage swirling around. And I remember feeling like I was swirling with them. I was riveted. Even as a young child, like, I could feel the energy and the power of that art. And the next day, of course, I begged my mother to let me take lessons, and that was the beginning of my performing arts career. You can draw a line connecting that pivotal experience from that point through my career to this moment we are in right now. The life-changing power of art swept me up and sent me on a lifelong journey. And in that moment, staring at little floating dots, I was transformed. Artwork is real work. Now more than ever, our society is in desperate need of transformation. We are suffering as we veil ourselves from the ravages of war and famine and genocide around the world. We sit by as bigotry and gun violence, poverty, houselessness, and despair further exacerbates the drug crisis and the mental health crisis and the teen suicide crisis across the country. Our humanity needs the kind of transformative impact that comes from poetry and dance, music, fine art, and storytelling. We need to access the rich resource that only the arts can deliver as a conduit for deepening our understanding of the human condition. And we need artists to reconnect us to our ability to be empathetic and compassionate towards one another. As we continue to careen into this dark age-like response to the age of information, I'm reminded that our connection to the arts can be as driven by our desire to be enlightened through our imagination as it can through our fear of the unknown. However, as we censor ourselves as a society from access to the tools that expand our understanding and deepen our grace for one another, I am reminded that history teaches us that a dark age precedes an enlightened one. And enlightenment is fueled by the ingenuity, curiosity, and fortitude of people who explore, express, and examine our world through art making. And with that in mind, why are we always trying to prove that the work we do is real? For example, during the pandemic, I, an artist, founded the nonprofit Professional Theater Coalition to advocate for federal funding. You heard all about that. You know, the beginning of the work, we asked if we could procure funding to help support our artists who were connected to our theaters, and we were laughed at. One lobbyist said that the federal government would never give us money to give to artists. That's what unemployment is for. And it was laughable that we would want to even try. So why laughable? We were representing some of the most impactful arts organizations in the country. One would think that the primary purpose of an arts organization, especially one as well-resourced as my former organization once was, would be the very place that the federal government would rely on to provide funding for artists. After all, we were their primary employers. And why the cynicism? I believe it's because we don't live in a culture that sees the need to support artists. We regard arts making and practice as more a hobby than a profession. And yet hundreds of thousands of artists around this country drive so much of our economy. How can we continue viewing an industry that makes up more of our GDP than agriculture and mining combined as a luxury or a frivolity and a purview for the elite? There are more than 2.5 million arts and culture workers in this country, and yet we cut art programs in schools, even though we know that students who participate in arts education are more likely to go to college than to jail. Artwork is real work, and yet, in my experience as a freelance director, I have been exploited, underpaid, underestimated, undermined, my ideas extracted while the fruits of my labor undervalued. I was once asked in confirmation bias, you know, when somebody asks you the question they already know the answer to for themselves, if I believed it was normal for artists to have to wait weeks and weeks after starting the work to be paid. I once asked my finance office to create a system that paid the most vulnerable, lowest paid employee first and me, the artistic leader, last. And they told me it wasn't possible. And changing the system would be disastrous to the organization. Why? Even the systems we use to make our art were not created to support the work of the artist. During the pandemic, when every performing arts venue was mandated to close, artists, especially those of the global majority, were without financial security. Still, they came together to demand change during the so-called racial reckoning of 2020. And institutions across the country, across the art sector, responded with statements and hirings and promises. And many of us, especially those who are amongst the most marginalized, knew that the promises were empty. We knew they didn't believe that the call for change was for the good of the entire industry, of the society. And while some of my colleagues across the country expressed fear that they would be outed for their bias and ambivalence, I and a handful of mostly BIPOC and women artistic leaders focused on shifting our organizations from extraction to being intentional about the artist and their work. All of us had inherited legacy organizations with huge structural deficits, and now we were faced with saving them from sunsetting. And it would have been normative, but not progressive, nor financially responsible to go back to the status quo. Instead, as we reopened, I was clear that my mandate was to reform the structures and the systems our organization was founded on in order to create a new paradigm for artists, or risk rebuilding the costly old and existing systems of harm. And you can imagine my surprise at the vitriolic response I received for shifting the focus of that 85-year-old institution to centering the artist. My life was threatened. The local news outlets used their publications as a bully pulpit. And the local community took their complaints about me to next door, which is basically Yelp for your disgruntled neighbors. I was lambasted for focusing on the artists, not for the art itself, but for the audacity to decenter the legacy audience and donors who were led to believe that they were the sole reason for the organization's existence. Even a local artist and a well-known playwright called to tell me that they supported me, but they didn't know how to explain to their neighbors why centering the artist was so important. Come on. At a time when Americans feel more stressed, face mental health challenges, and feel more disparate from one another due to our socio-political climate, the arts can serve as a unifier and a touchstone for our humanity, directly impacting our individual and collective well-being. President Biden even said in an October 2022 proclamation that the arts are essential to the well-being, health, vitality, and democracy of our nation. They are the soul of America, reflecting our multicultural, sorry, that's not even a word anymore, and democratic experience. His administration seeks to integrate the arts, humanities, museum and library services into policies, programs, and partnerships throughout the federal government to tackle the greatest challenges of our time, such as the climate crisis and the scourge of hate-fueled violence, to keep pushing forward to form a more perfect union. And just recently, the World Health Organization announced a research collaboration which presented evidence on the role of arts in improving health and well-being. The report identified the contribution that the arts have in promoting good health and health equity, but also in preventing illness and treating acute and chronic conditions. As an artist, I'm focused on creating more and better solutions. My mandate is to discover how we can leverage the arts to create a better world. And that's why I signed on as co-artistic director of One Nation, One Project and their Arts and Health Initiative, Arts for Everybody. You can advance the slide. I think that's the next thing. This project was conceived by a theater director, Lyra DeBassinet. She was seeking solutions to the disparities uncovered during the COVID crisis. She found her inspiration by looking back to the New Deal and the Federal Theater Project, which produced It Can't Happen Here simultaneously in 18 cities across the country in 1836. Nearly a century later, on this year, on July 27, 2024, the Arts for Everybody initiative will bring together 18 cities and towns across the country to unveil an array of large-scale participatory art projects simultaneously. Each will reflect their communities by premiering distinct artworks, responding to the prompt, "There's no place like home." In big cities and rural counties, hundreds of artists will create new works. From Rhinelander, Wisconsin, to Utica, Mississippi, Honolulu to Oakland to Providence, Rhode Island. It will be a national artistic outpouring of local reflection and joy, with so many sites piloting cross-sector partnerships amongst local artists, healthcare providers, and municipal leaders to bring health and well-being to the larger community. We endeavor to create a bold, new awareness of the impact that having greater access to arts and artistic practice can have on our physical and mental health. And we're working with Dr. Jill Sankey, the director of the Center for Arts and Wellness at the University of Florida, working with her team to collect data to analyze the effects participation in these events has on the communities that it services. And my personal hope is that these partnerships and the research gleaned from our work will lead to more collaborations, increased investment in local artists by centering them as a necessary part of creating greater health and well-being in communities nationwide, centering their work as essential. And what's more, it's a model that can be replicated across sectors, across states, over and over until we get it right. We're in Phillips County, Arkansas. We're in the Bronx. We're here in California, in Oakland, across the country and around every community and neighborhood. We're doing the work because artwork is the real work. I trust artists throughout history and into the present because they have their ears to the ground and their hands on the pulse of humanity. Artists provide their hearts to help us deepen our empathy and their minds to broaden our horizons to what's necessary and possible to make a brighter and more equitable future. And to support that future, I maintain that instead of being extractive, our world must be transformed to include intentional ways for artists to thrive. We must be intentional about the artist, about how we train them to make art, how the art they create, the resources they need, where that money comes from, the access and disability support that is required for them to be successful, the audience that is being invited, and consciousness about the future projects that they are birthing. From museum curators to the performing arts makers to craft artisans and community choirs, the entire support system that surrounds the art and the artist must be intentional, with everybody pointed towards the same goal, because it is the real work. Artists are thought leaders and change makers who transform culture, reflecting our current humanity back to ourselves. We must endeavor to shift the national psyche so that artists are neither at the bottom or the top of the hierarchy, but at the heart. We do this by empowering them, hiring them, paying a living wage, by supporting their work, by uplifting their messages. I believe the artists and their work is a prescription for a better now and a brighter future. And the prescription pad reads, artwork is real work. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on Voices of the Community. We've heard from inspiring leaders like Nafisha Ezreal, Letitia Rye Buckley, Julie Baker, and Nataki Garrett, who are championing the arts throughout California. Want to support their work? Head over to voicesofthecommunity.com and click on Where Art Meets Impact, and then Episode 1, Opening and Keynote. While you're there, explore our website for more in-depth interviews and stories from the Arts and Culture series, sign up for our newsletter to stay connected, and then take the next step, donate or volunteer to uplift our arts community and ensure its continued vibrancy. Today's episode was made possible through our co-production partnership with California for the Arts at their second annual California Arts and Culture Summit. Special thanks to our technical crew, audio and video wizard Eric Estrada, and our production partner Bayvac Media and their team, Paula Argoni, Andy Konami, Javon Giles, and Clay Goh. Thanks to Casey Nez from Citron Studios for the graphics magic. A special thanks to our broadcast partners who help share these important conversations, KSFP LPFM in San Francisco, KPCA LPFM in Petaluma, Petaluma Community Public Access TV, and Bayvac Media's SF Commons Public Access TV. Thank you for your commitment to amplifying diverse voices and perspectives. Please support these partners and our mission by tuning in and spreading the word. Voices of the Community is made possible by generous support from the Zellerbach Family Foundation, dedicated to ensuring vibrant work is created, new voices celebrated, and diverse communities have opportunities to thrive. Learn more at zff.org. We're also supported by the Peaceful World Foundation, fostering a culture of global peace through hosted conversations and education. Discover more at peacefulworldfoundation.org. And we love your support to continue to make shows just like this one. Go to georgecoster.com and click on the donate button. Take Voices of the Community with you on the go. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Enjoying the show? Please rate and review us. It helps more people discover these important stories. Watch past and future episodes on YouTube by searching for Geo Coster. Have feedback or ideas? We'd love to hear from you. Email George at georgecoster.com. I'm George Koster from San Francisco. On behalf of our team, thank you for joining us. Until next time, remember, your voice matters.